From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, John Lasseter, who was forced out of Pixar Animation Studios for inappropriate behavior, is offered a new Hollywood job. The industry debates what it means for the Me Too movement. And we visit with The Good Place creator Mike Schur and writer-producer Jen Statsky to discuss the ethical questions at the heart of their TV comedy.
I wanted to do a show about, practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person?
The response I've gotten is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad.
All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
In Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman and nominated for a leading 12 BAFTA Awards, awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Just a few days into the new year, the ongoing reckoning in Hollywood around sexual harassment and gender equity is being tested yet again. Yesterday, the film company Skydance announced that John Lasseter had been hired to run its new animation division. Skydance is a production company run by David Ellison, the son of Oracle billionaire Larry Ellison. Organizations including Time's Up and Women in Film swiftly denounced the hiring. John Lasseter has been regarded as a creative genius in animation. He co-founded Pixar, was instrumental to its success and its multi-billion dollar sale to Disney. He then also helped overhaul Disney Animation, essentially reinventing that studio's approach to the art form that it had created. But in late 2017, Lasseter's behavior in the workplace, which reportedly included giving women unwanted hugs and comments about their physical appearance, ultimately forced him out of the company. His job at Skydance has triggered a range of responses. Rebecca Keegan is covering the story for The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, I spoke to a lot of people in animation yesterday, both male and female, and heard a mixture of things, but particularly from women, and particularly from young women in animation, that they consider this a sign of that company's values, and they don't want to work there. I also heard from some people that John Lasseter is such a legend and such a creative genius that they would be willing to either look the other way or assume that they wouldn't be managed by him directly. If an opportunity at Skydance came up, they would go.
I think it's important to note, even though they're very different cases, that Harvey Weinstein was not successful when all of these allegations came out against him. And John Lasseter was, not only at Pixar, but also at Walt Disney Animation. He had a huge role in the theme parks. And I'm wondering, and we're going to have to speculate a little bit here, if that played into David Ellison's interest in hiring John Lasseter.
Well, I think it's important to keep the severity of the allegations in mind when we're talking about these cases. Harvey Weinstein is currently on trial for sexual assault. John Lasseter was not accused of that or anything really close to that. These were much milder allegations that surfaced regarding Lasseter, and they were not on the record. So it's not only that these two men had very different careers, but that the things they are accused of doing are very different. Having said that, John Lasseter is really a titan in the entertainment industry in a very different way from Harvey Weinstein. He has generated billions of dollars at the box office, played a key role at Disney theme parks, and really completely reinvented the animation industry. So certainly there was reason to continue to take him seriously as a creative person and a businessman if for some reason these allegations were either dealt with or apologized for or disproven.
On top of what a number of people are saying about the hiring, three of Hollywood's leading organizations promoting workplace equality and fighting sexual harassment all came out against Ellison's hiring of Lasseter. Time's Up said in a statement, quote, "Skydance Media's decision to hire John Lasseter as head of animation endorses and perpetuates a broken system that allows powerful men to act without consequence," unquote. What are people telling you about the system's ability to change?
Well, one thing I heard from some of the female animators that I spoke with is that they didn't feel like there was any evidence that Lassiter had done any self-examination. There was a memo which David Ellison, the CEO of Skydance, sent to the staff, which said, effectively, you know, we're aware of the incidents, alleged incidents in Lassiter's past. We've investigated them, and we are comfortable with hiring him. For the women I spoke to, that was not a sufficient kind of reckoning with the issue. They wanted to hear, well, what specifically did you find in your investigation? What specifically has Lassiter done in this time that he has been away from Disney and Pixar that would suggest that there's been some evolution?
So what sort of self-reflection are people saying might be sufficient? Or what could John Lasseter do or have done that might have changed a little bit the way that he is perceived?
Well, it's noteworthy that Lasseter has not spoken publicly since he left Disney. So we don't honestly know what Lasseter has been doing. So, you know, if he had made some sort of partnership with Time's Up, if he had involved himself in some sort of organization where he would have potentially been grappling with some of the issues of culture at Pixar in particular that people complained about. There was a lot of conversation at the time that Lasseter left Pixar about a kind of boys club culture at Pixar that he helped to create. If there had been any sense that he had examined that, understood that, either via working with a group like Time's Up or through some other means, I think that would be eye-opening for some people.
This story has prompted a couple of, I think, bigger, larger questions about Hollywood and about business culture generally. And one is that in Hollywood's quest to get the most box office money, it will set aside considerations or worries it has about somebody's character and just hire somebody who has a successful track record. And then there's the flip side of that. And there are a lot of these comments on websites that have posted stories about Lasseter, which is, at what point do you keep being penalized? Is there no such thing as a second chance? How do you think this story is kind of crystallizing those two ideas at the same time?
Yes, it's interesting because Lasseter, if you had sort of a sliding scale based on the severity of a person's allegations and their impact on the entertainment industry, Lasseter is probably the person who's had the most impact on the industry with the least severe allegations. So he is someone who you might expect to be among the first to return and potentially do so with some success. Having said that, it's also noteworthy where he is returning. Skydance is owned by David Ellison. Lasseter is not returning to a big public company. He's not returning to one of the traditional studios or to a company like, say, Netflix or to Apple. And I do know that he has taken meetings at important big companies around town. So you can, I think, draw some conclusions about where he's ending up, that those meetings were not fruitful.
And it's also worth noting that Lasseter has never been charged with a crime. But even if you forgive someone, it doesn't mean you have to give them a job, right?
It's true. And look, clearly he has a lot of wealth. He has an enormous winery in Napa. He has other things he can do with his life besides come back and run a company in the very industry where his allegations first surfaced.
Rebecca Keegan is the senior editor for film at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, The Good Place is the rare network sitcom that can make you laugh and re-examine your own behavior.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman and nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, and 12 BAFTA Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories. Now playing.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The Good Place returns tonight, and with it, so does America's weekly lesson in how to be good. The NBC comedy, anchored by co-stars Kristen Bell and Ted Danson, began in 2016 as a show about the afterlife, but in many ways it has become about how people treat each other while they're still alive. There's even a character named Chidi, played by William Jackson Harper, who is a moral philosophy professor and who gives ethics lessons to the others. And whether you realize it or not, as you watch, you're learning something too. Last fall, we visited with the creator and showrunner of The Good Place, Mike Schur. He was joined by Jen Statsky, who is a writer and producer on the show. Schur also created Parks and Recreation, and Statsky worked with him on that show as well. Before we began talking about how they weave ethics into comedy, Schur told us about an upcoming trip he was about to take.
I was invited because of the philosophical discussions that take place on The Good Place. I was invited to attend the annual conference of the National Association of Sartre Scholars. This is not a joke, the highest honor I have ever received in my life. I could not be more excited. It's in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and I am at Mary Washington University. I'm flying there in 2 weeks with Todd May, who is a professor at Clemson, who's an advisor for the show, who is actually a Sartre scholar. So when I was invited, I said, that's very flattering. You should ideally invite one person who knows what he's talking about to this. And so I recommended Todd, which it worked out perfectly because he works on the show and he knows the subject matter. So the two of us are going to attend this annual convention, and it's going to be amazing.
I think it's fair to say that philosophy is more than a Trojan horse in this series, that in many ways, if you know about philosophy and care about philosophy and care about moral arguments, that you can really engage with this show unlike probably any other primetime show. Has that been something that you always intended? Has it been more, has that response been greater than you initially expected?
I don't know what I expected, frankly. It was just always the way the show was that it was baked into the premise. It wasn't like a thing that we were going to kind of dabble in or that was like on the surface. It was the idea here was always this show is about people trying to be better in whatever way that meant to them to be better people. And the sort of lens we were looking through was ethics. You know, I did a lot of research about the afterlife when I was first developing the show, conceptions of the afterlife in different religions, and they were all very interesting, but that doesn't help you be a better person, right? At some level, the concept of heaven or a sort of celestial reward was just, it's just like, if you're a good person, you get this awesome thing. And it wasn't prescriptive. It wasn't like because it was like your life is over and now you just get to hang out in heaven. More or less in every religion, that's what it promises you. So I wanted to do a show about what's practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person? And the proper kind of set of books to read are books about ethics, because that's like, hey, if you're in this situation, here's what you should think about and here's how you should act. So it became, that was the show. That's how the show sort of developed.
Jen, I want to ask you, as a writer, let's just say hypothetically, but maybe actually in truth, there's going to be an episode that's going to talk about utilitarianism, the idea that like the best thing to do is what benefits the greatest number of people.
Right.
And you are saying to yourself or the other writers, but we have to make something that's entertaining, that's funny.
Right.
How do you negotiate that territory?
Sure. Yeah. I think anytime you're crafting an episode of TV, there's so many different parts of it. We talk a lot about like, what's the comedy engine of this episode? Like, what is the funny situation this person is put in? And then you're talking on a broader level about theme. And so, for example, in the trolley problem episode,
this is a thought experiment first introduced by British philosopher Philippa Foot in 1967.
That is something where you're able to tackle head on this utilitarian idea.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
Situational
do we know
ethics.
Yes.
Like, is one of them an ex-boyfriend? Or that snooty girl from Rite Aid who was always silently judging my purchases? It's like, yeah, Chicky, a Baby Ruth and birth control. I see the irony. Keep a swiping.
You don't know any of the workers.
Okay, well, then that's easy. I switch tracks. Kill one person instead of five.
But what we've always tried to do is, like, be creative about what are the ways that we can put these themes and these ideas and these broader ideas into the episode, but present it in a funny way for the audience.
Jen, could you tell me a little bit about what it means to be kind of schooled in philosophy, to actually have the instructions or books or articles that writers on this show are expected to look at and consider, and how that changes your approach to writing on this series?
Well, as a person who mostly is interested, grew up watching pro wrestling and now watches Keeping Up with the Kardashians a lot, it's incredibly overwhelming. But it's been super exciting, honestly. Like, getting to work on a TV show is a huge privilege in its own right. And then we've had one of the coolest parts of this show is that, like Mike mentioned, like, we have philosophers come in and give us lectures on these topics, on the trolley problem, on utilitarianism. And it's amazing. Like, that, I've worked in a bunch of writers' rooms now. I've never had an experience that's like, not only do I get to write a great show I love, it's like being in college again, and I didn't pay attention in college, so it's amazing to get to do it over. So it's been great.
We're talking with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky about their show, The Good Place. We're visiting with them on the lot of NBC Universal. Mike, I want to ask you about Pamela Hieronymi, who is a philosophy professor at UCLA. Mm-hmm. How did you reach out to her? How did she come to work on the show? What was that first contact like?
So I felt very strongly that I was in over my head after doing a bunch of my own reading while developing the show. And I thought, well, it would be really helpful if there were a professor or two who could on whom I could rely for information and for clarity. And so I just poked around on the UCLA website, and I found this woman, Pamela Hieronymi, and she had written a number of papers that I thought sounded like they might be relevant to what we were discussing. And I just wrote her an email out of the blue and said, hi, I'm a TV producer. I'm local. Could you ever possibly meet with me? And just, I can ask you a bunch of questions. And she said, sure. And so we made a date to meet for coffee on the West Side in Santa Monica at a certain time. And I, at a Starbucks, and I went to the Starbucks and she didn't show up. And I was like, oh no, did I get this wrong? And I kept checking. I was like, no, this is right. And finally I sent her an email. I was like, I'm sorry, did I get the date wrong? I'm so sorry. And then an hour and a half, she texted me or wrote me back and was like, oh my God, I totally forgot about our meeting. I'm sorry, I'll be right there. And and she came and she was incredibly apologetic. She had been like working or writing or doing something that a philosophy professor does. And we ended up talking for a long time. I asked her a million questions. She gave me a million answers. It was incredibly helpful. She then later, she's been a sort of like check-in person, like Professor May has as well, where when we don't understand something, we will email her. She came in and gave us, she teaches an intro class at UCLA, and her first class is about the trolley problem. And so when we were going to write an episode about it, she came in and essentially gave us her day one intro to philosophy trolley problem class. And she led us through the entire thing. And even though we kind of knew what was coming, it was still super fun. And it became that episode. And we're forever grateful to her.
One of the premises of the show is that if you want to do something good, you sometimes need help doing it. That there's strength in numbers and that community can be really important in changing how you behave. Was that something that you settled on as an idea early? Was it something you took away from your own readings about philosophy? Because it does seem to be a central tenet of the show.
It's something I personally believed. So I think I was looking for the philosophical ideas that supported my belief, which is a pretty classic move in the history of thought, right? But in this case, Pamela Hieronymi's thesis advisor is a famous philosopher named Tim Scanlon, who taught at Harvard, where she was a graduate student, and he had this book called What We Owe to Each Other, and it takes the position that the sort of way to formulate a society is by sitting down with everyone around you, assuming that you are all appropriately motivated and reasonable people, and figuring out what rules you can agree to that would not be objected to by the other people around you. It's a pretty simple idea, but it really kind of struck a chord with me because in Pamela's words, she calls it the can't we all just get along philosophy. And it's like, we all need to survive. And the only way we can survive is if we can come up with rules that other people who are reasonably motivated and decent people won't object to. That sort of crystallized for me what I had been feeling about this. And it really sort of then seeped into the show where, like, there's four human beings who are all unwittingly sort of linked together by an evil demon who's trying to torture them. And I thought, boy, it would be cool if we could say, well, that's how they came to know each other. And the way that they're going to survive is by flipping that on its ear and saying, like, the only way we get through this is with each other's help. That seems like a pretty good sort of arc for four people on a TV show. And that's what the show has become.
After a short break, The Frame will be back, and so will Mike Schur and Jen Statsky from The Good Place. So stick around.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky. We're talking on the Universal lot where they produce the NBC comedy, The Good Place. The show returns tonight to continue its third season. The series began with four characters who find themselves in a bizarre afterlife that first seemed like heaven, but was actually a kind of hell. By now, it's a show about people grappling with what most of us are all grappling with on some level, and that is how to be a better person. Here's Jen Statsky.
I think that the response I've gotten from people who are fans of the show has overwhelmingly, in a very flattering way, and I think Mike gets this too, is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad and people are not treating each other well. Like, it's easy to write off and say, hey, it's just a TV show, who cares? But the truth of the matter is what an incredible privilege to be able to make things that get blasted into people's homes, and these ideas that you put out into the world are things that they hear and internalize and think about. And so the fact that the show has resulted in people saying, like, it's actually made me think about how I treat people and being a good person and ethics, like, that to me is the most rewarding thing that can come out of it.
And Mike, what about you in terms of, like, the workplace? Because there have been a lot of stories over the last couple of years, but you could have written these stories for decades about the way that people are treated in Hollywood. And it could be people of color, it could be women, it could be people with disabilities, it could be pay equity. There are any number of issues that this town has not been really good about. So when you're thinking about how you're going to apply ethical behavior to the running of your own show, the way you're going to talk to other people, the kinds of people you want to work with, the kinds of people you're going to fire because you don't like the way they behave, do you feel that you're a different producer having thought about these issues in making this series?
I think I'm a different person, and I suppose being a different producer would be part of that. I've become more interested about more aspects of human life and ethics because of the show. I think that would be accurate to say. I would also say that, you said that Hollywood has not treated certain people so well. Let's be clear. Hollywood has treated almost everyone terribly. Hollywood has a shameful and miserable past and, frankly, present about all people of color, all women especially. It's only in the last couple of years that most of the misery that Hollywood as a machine has created has even begin to come to light. And it's disgusting. It's horrible. It makes me feel ashamed to be a part of the industry. I'm thrilled that it's changing, which it is. It's finally being exposed, and it's finally sort of like coming out of how deep and systemic the problems really are. there's a thing that happens in Hollywood because creativity is elusive and it's gossamer and it's sort of, it floats in the air and no one can quite define it or recreate it sometimes. You know, it's, what does it mean to be a movie star? Who, why is this person a movie star? Why is that person not a movie star? How is this, you know, writer capable of writing this amazing thing and then 1 year later, this terrible thing? It's, it all feels very slippery. And as a result, when people sort of show it for whatever reason that they have the ability to be consistently good at what they do, in the past, they've been allowed to get away with anything. And that is how monsters are made. It's when the system of basic human checks and balances breaks down, people get away with anything they want. If they're making enough people enough money, and if they are if they're sort of like just driving forward in this kind of crazy big power machine. And as a result, one of the bad side effects of that is that people have begun to say, or for years and decades have said, well, this part of the creative process, right? This treating people terribly is just like, that's, you just have to accept that as part of the creative process. That's insane. No, you don't. It's, no one should ever treat people terribly for any reason. And certainly it doesn't, there's certainly no moral calculation where you would say like, it's okay to treat people terribly in whatever way that means if you create something good. I mean, that's absurd. What kind of world are we living in if it's okay to be deeply cruel to some people in order to get something like a good like screenplay or something? That's an insane calculation that people made and have stuck to for decades and decades. It's finally changing. You've finally begun to see companies and individuals and people in Hollywood say, we are not going to tolerate terrible behavior in exchange for either successful product or just creatively interesting product. And thank goodness.
Mike, let me ask you this last question. I think what's interesting, and this is totally anecdotal, is that the show is watched by families. How unusual is that for you to have a show where families watch a show that's hitting people at very different levels based on their age, their education, and where they are in life?
That anecdote of like, I watch it with my family has been said to me about Parks and Recreation. It's been said about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It was said about The Office, which I did not create or adapt. That was Greg Daniels, but I wrote on that show. And I think that if there's a sort of unifying idea behind all those shows, it's that, first of all, they're on NBC, and so there's less, you know, cursing and nudity and stuff, and parents feel like it's a little bit safer, even if some of the humor is a little bit more adult, but it's not so adult that you have to worry. But I think that those shows are ensemble shows. They have a large number of characters who represent a large number of viewpoints on the world. And there is some kind of unifying theme there that I learned from Greg, which is that your life is your relationships with other people. At some fundamental level, that is what makes your days pass. It is your sort of bonds with other people that matters in the world. And so I would guess, and this, I'm not a psychologist, but I would guess that if there's a reason that families gather to watch those shows, that has something to do with it.
Mike and Jen, thanks so much for letting us come visit.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Mike Schur is the creator of the comedy The Good Place. Jen Statsky is a writer and producer on the show. It airs Thursday nights on NBC. And that is it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.